go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Nobody should be working full time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious as insecure as so many people do today.
And Rich, what did you make of these sort of contributions to the documentary, these stories of McDonald's worker and also sort of farmer in the documentary also?
I think it's just an example of the thing that a lot of people are feeling, and it's regardless of what your political views are, that feeling like, why is life getting worse? Why is my paycheck not going as far as it went 5 years ago? Why do I feel like I'm earning less money and everything costs a lot more? There's something wrong here. When the wealthy people are just getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and they're buying cars and houses and they're living and they're talking about how booming the economy is, and I'm not feeling that. And those stories reflect that, reflect something that almost all of us feel, unless we're in that top 1%, I think.
And Clive, I want to ask that question that Robert Reich raises. Why is it that people who are working full-time are struggling to make ends meet in one of the richest countries in the world?
There's an inevitability in where we've got to. I referred earlier that the post-war consensus did actually give people some semblance of a decent life. They were working hard, but they were being well rewarded. They didn't have to have multiple jobs. But I think that respite was only temporary, and there's a much deeper underlying problem than what the documentary brings out. But what the documentary, the power of the documentary, is that it begins people on a journey of understanding. It may not go the whole way, but it certainly introduces concepts that may be totally alien to them. And having these stories actually puts them into the context of their own lives. But there is an inevitability to this idea that things get worse and worse, because essentially the wealth is sucked to the top, and there are very simple mechanisms that drive that, and it's to do with theft of what should belong to everyone, land, resources, etc., and usury, because it's just a straight interest on money, it's just a straight wealth transfer mechanism.
She said she had to take payday loans.
Exactly.
And of course,
so that just
never
exacerbates
debt.
It. So this process, in days gone by, we had debt jubilees. And basically everything would be forgiven, we'd start afresh, and the system would reset. 1929 was a reset, and that's why all those laws were so effective, because it reset the economy. We had a crash in 87, we had a crash in 98, we had a crash in 2000, we had one in 2008. We've not had a reset. All that's happened is that the Fed has continued to pile more money into the system, which has done nothing to alleviate the hardship of people like that lady at McDonald's, but it's gone into asset prices, driving more of the wealth to the top. So the system needs a reset, and the fear is that the reset will be much too painful. It'll be like the 1930s depression. And if we want to avoid that, we have to think in a different way. That doesn't come out of the film, but if this starts people on a journey of understanding...
At least it's a good starting point, yes.
Yeah, I think it does a very good job of opening the door to concepts that people probably don't think about, although they feel them, as Rich says, on a daily basis in their own lives.
And Rich, before we move on, I just quickly wanted to touch on the point you made about Reich earlier on, about him. You can tell, you get a sense from the documentary, he's trying really hard, he's been a senior political figure in America, but it doesn't seem like he's getting anywhere, and you can see his spirits sort of go down throughout the years.
But it's just you know, watching the system get worse and worse. And he talks about seeing the seeds of what we're seeing now, seeing it back in the 80s, you know, and realizing that this was going to happen. It was just going to get worse and worse. And
you can feel that sense of frustration from him.
Yeah,
also.
You do see him getting frustrated, and you saw him like in the clips from when he was working with Clinton, and he's trying to change things, and of course he can't, because every bill he proposes is heavily compromised by exceptions and things, and which just basically made the situation even worse. Mm-hmm. So you do watch him kind of getting more and more demoralized, and then this film is basically his journey around the country to try to make sense of that and work a way forward. It is, like you say, it's a it's an opening of the door to the theme. It doesn't really get that deep into it, mm-hmm. but it helps you understand in a way that you kind of makes you think, and you think, oh, maybe I do need to pay attention to the candidates mm-hmm. more when the next election comes around, and pay attention to what they're saying.
Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars. With the four drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month per treatment. So for me, that's about 3 months of income. just for one round of treatment. What is the alternative to receiving your chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than any citizens of any advanced nation.
So you think medicine should save people, not bankrupt them. Rich, what impression did you get of the pharmaceutical industry from the documentary?
Personally, you know, I live in the UK, and our government right now is trying to create that system here, which is terrifying to me. That's terrifying.
Increasing privatization.
Yeah, and making it so that we have to pay for everything, even though we already pay for it. I find that really disturbing. But, this clip is part of a bigger point in the film. Because he talks about how Americans pay more for airfares, they pay more for, you know, virtually everything. Internet access, mobile phones, everything is more expensive because of these special interests that have created laws that basically give them bigger profits. And that these companies are regulated outside of America because they're considered public utilities and they're not allowed to have obscene profits. Mm-hmm. Because they're utilities, they're something everybody has to have. And
of course, essential.
And that's kind of the. It's a bigger point in the film is that these essential services shouldn't be allowed to make, obscene profits, make people poor. Basically.
Would you agree with what Rich said? Your thoughts on this sort of free-for-all economy?
On the pharmaceutical industry specifically, I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how we got here. Rockefeller was one of the original Rockefellers was a snake oil salesman. And he basically, through endowing universities, medical schools, and health facilities, basically alienated the whole idea of natural medicine. That lady said there's no alternative. There are alternatives, actually effective alternatives. And the pharmaceutical industry is not about curing people. It's about making money. And if people get better, that's a side benefit. It's certainly not the main thrust. So the cost is part of this, but it's actually the industry itself is perpetuating illness because it's profitable. And if you look at the insured model, and Rich mentioned what's happening in this country, you go back pre the start of this privatization regime, management costs in the UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a secret study done. It's not been published. It's been available through leaks in various places. I think we're up to about 14%. But where we're heading to is 20% of the cost going into management. In other words, going back up to
that is
the
very
top.
Worrying indeed. And just as we end near the end of the show, I'd just like to discuss one of the key messages of this documentary, which is the power of ordinary citizens, I suppose, to rise up and to challenge the 1%. Clive, Rich, do you think that this documentary ends on a hopeful note?
I mean, so many of these documentaries that make you angry end up by saying, vote, use your vote, get out and protest. And, that message has been going on we're 10 years into this economic system, this new world that we're living in, and it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. So
just your final thoughts on the film now.
Yeah, so I think the film helps raise issues that need to be raised, and we need to watch these kinds of films so that we understand what's going on. And maybe that will help us use our vote more wisely and get out and protest where it's effective. But it does kind of make you feel a little hopeless.
I'm afraid we'll have to end it on a sad note there. But I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. You will become of steely if, in the first place, a young student should engage in self-edification. Build your characters through religious training, education, educators, and educational speakers are all needed. But if there is not an inner mentor to train and educate you, such training will not be effective. Build your character and fight your ego. While you obeying God's command in your personal lives and engage in prayer, attention to God and relying on God, this will make you as strong as steel. 45. Your strongholds. Be vigilant. Watch out and fortify your strongholds so that the enemy cannot infiltrate in your fortifications. With a strong spirit of faith, you can defeat the colonizers and disarm them. To let your nation breathe, build your country, improve your lives, and solve problems inherited to us by years of colonization and exploitation at the hands of foreigners.
يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 ليتك دوما قريب
Six, breaking that idol. We need to revive in ourselves the spirit of submission to God. Submission to God means surrender to God. That is breaking the idol within us, that is ego, which emerges in many cases. When your interests are threatened, when no one agrees with you, when something against your desires, even if your desire contradicts the law, happens, or when you have to choose between your personal gain and your duty. In those difficult moments, when the ego emerges. If we can inhibit this ego, this temptation, this pharaoh lies within every one of us, or at least if we can control it to some degree, we'll become humans, and we will reach salvation. The month of Ramadan is a prelude to this. Fasting, prayer with attention, donating to the poor, and even jihad for Allah are all aimed at guiding mankind to a world where people submit to God.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
got debate.
We have made some progress, but there's still a long way to go. That has been the prognosis of the talks pretty much since it began in Vienna. One stance, however, has been held and not changed, and that is Iran's insistence that all sanctions be removed. Meanwhile, the U.S. is still struggling to accept that while it continues with the negotiations. In this edition of the debate, we will look at what these sanctions are and why the U.S. is reluctant to accept what Iran sees as a deal maker or a deal breaker.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Two working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran, and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the U.S. Now a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the most important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Homa Lizki, Vienna.
For our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Fouad Azadi, university professor and political analyst, who joins us. We also have Said Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Fouad Azadi, let me first start with you. Our reporter there ended it with there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. Another statement that we've heard, we have made some progress, but there's still a ways to go. So we're left confused here, and we're hoping that you could perhaps enlighten us as to what is going on in Vienna and whether there has been progress or not, and in what form or manner.
Right. I don't blame you for being confused. This is a manufactured confusion. The issue is not that complicated. What Iran needs is to be able to sell oil, and Iran needs to get that money inside the country. It's that simple. And the reason the American side is engaging in this type of behavior, making things complicated, confusing things, demanding things that has nothing to do with Iran's nuclear program, is because they don't want to do what I just said. They don't want to let Iran sell oil, and they don't want Iran to be able to get that money back. And their level of dedication to the issue of human rights is at the level of not even allowing Iran to use its own money to buy corona vaccines. And at the same time that they talk about human rights, they engage in this type of anti-human behavior. So unfortunately, in the new U.S. government, we basically see the same war crimes mentality that the U.S. officials get to have once they enter the White House, and probably they have that mentality before and after their White House tenure. And that is the basic problem. So in order not to do what they need to do, which is let Iran sell oil and let Iran get the money, they create this atmosphere of confusion, and unfortunately we have the European countries that are following that line, and that's why we are at the situation that we are.
Yeah, so Sayed Mohsen Abbas, you know, we hear what Professor Izzadi has said there. At the same time, we know that there's been a number of meetings that have taken place. There are explanations that are given by the Iranian side that basically say the only path for the U.S. is to for rejoining the JCPOA is full compliance, the removal of all sanctions, which includes the Obama-era sanctions, the sanctions restored by Trump, the additional sanctions in the Trump era labeled as non-nuclear and whatnot. But basically, the U.S. appears that they just want to come back with categorizing the sanctions, dividing the sanctions, maybe keeping the human rights ones, human rights issues that it says Iran is violating, which goes maybe contrary to what our Professor Izzadi said, because some understanding there is out there that the U.S. will keep the human rights sanctions, but will maybe allow, we don't know any of this yet, but maybe allow the oil to go through. It's really, again, confusing. Let me hear your take on what is going on.
Well, I think, first of all, I have to contextualize the JCPOA within the actual broad objectives of the United States in the Middle East. And, of course, none of those objectives are ones which the Islamic Republic of Iran is going to comply with. And therefore, the JCPOA becomes really, for me, quite a kind of red herring. It's a sort of it's a kind of a sideshow, a distraction in many ways, because you know, the things that America wants really is regime change. They fundamentally, at the core of their policy, are committed to the Islamic Republic of Iran's government collapsing, and they want to try and impose some sort of secular neoliberal establishment, which would, of course, then comply with everything they do in terms of their global systemic rape and pillage and other one. And that's absolutely clear. There's nothing that's changed on that front. So that's the first thing to note, that they will do nothing which will allow the Islamic Republic of Iran's current government to become more powerful or stronger. So as my colleague pointed out, the oil issue becomes very critical. The financial wheeling and dealing of Iran and its ability to generate funds or operate normally in the economies of the world is central to their pillar of destruction of the current government. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they don't want any interference by the Islamic Republic of Iran in West Asia in terms of its regional development. So, for instance, Israel has been appointed as their policeman. Israel is the one that is allowed to expand and to overrun and operate through puppet regimes like the Saudis, like, of course, even in Jordan, for instance, in Egypt. All of these regimes, these Arab regimes, have long since been really just proxies of Israel and America. So maintaining that status quo is really important for them. And of course, Iran's independent model, an example, its kind of moral stance on so many issues around fighting for the oppressed and giving people their sovereignty, their independence in that region, genuine sovereignty, all goes absolutely against the Americans. And of course, finally, it's the Iranian technological and other scientific developments, I think, which are really troubling both Israel and America, which are also influencing what they're doing around the JCPOA. So the technological developments largely in the nuclear field, in the ballistic missiles field, and in other drone technology, the military field particularly, troubles them. Of course, Iran's expanded on all sorts of levels in other ways as well, in terms of knowledge and advancing their own capabilities for being self-sufficient. But you see, therefore, what you're seeing with the JCPOA is really just part of a wider, range of problems they have with Iran. These problems won't go away by settling the JCPOA. either for Iran or for the United States. So I do rather feel that this is all just an excuse, and the way they're dragging their feet and delaying and making all these complications seems to me to be more of what they've done before, bluff, bluster, and trying to buy time to work out more ways to destroy Iran.
Okay, buying time is something that is one of the red lines, Professor Izadi, that Iran's leader has set for these talks, and I'm sure that the Iran's negotiating team is abiding by that, which is led by Abbas Araghchi. But I'm trying to ask from you, Professor Izadi, to again clarify the news that's out there, because there are many who are forming their conclusions or their ideas about what is going on in these talks by what they're hearing in the news. Now, this is one of them that Iran has rejected. The source is saying, according to sources close to European and U.S. negotiators, Mali is expected to offer Tehran a Goldilocks-style deal. This comes from Foreign Policy. Just enough sanctions relief so Iran will return to the pact, but not so much that it would leave Biden vulnerable to attacks from hardliners at home, including those in his own party who oppose any concessions at all to Iran. Iran has rejected that. Why is this? Why is there this type of news that's coming out, do you think?
I think the Biden administration doesn't want to comply with JCPOA. So a few minutes ago, Jake Sullivan talked on a news channel in the United States saying that the United States is interested in compliance for compliance. But when you read these type of news reports and analysis, in the American media, you realize that Jake Sullivan and Rob Malley and others that deal with this issue in the U.S. government, they are not telling you the truth. Because if they were really interested in complying with JCPOA, they didn't need to wait 3 months and engage in this type of prolonged negotiations. They could do to JCPOA what they did with the Paris Climate Accord. Just issue an executive order the way Biden did in the first week of his presidency, and the United States returned to that accord. And that's when you actually want to comply with an agreement, and that's the way you do it. And if you don't want to comply with an agreement, you start playing around with words, and you create confusion as you asserted your program with that idea. And, you know, saying that we have people in the U.S. Congress that oppose JCPOA, so we are not going to comply with JCPOA, is not an excuse. The internal power struggles in the United States, internal competitions between Republicans and Democrats, is not an Iranian problem. That's an internal issue for the United States. The U.S. Agreed to comply with JCPOA in 2015, said that it's one of the P5 plus one countries that is accepting the terms of JCPOA, and now, after 5 years, with the Trump administration trying to destroy JCPOA, the new administration in Washington suddenly remembers that there are people in the U.S. Congress that don't like JCPOA. So having this type of excuses, I don't think, is going to fly, and Iran's legitimate demand is that the agreement needs to be followed, and they have a choice to follow the agreement, and they can actually do comply with the agreement, and Iran has said that the Iranian government will do the same, or they can make confusion. It's a choice that they have. Either way, I think Iranian government is confident that even without an agreement with the United States, the country can continue to grow and become stronger, and realizing that there is no difference between Republicans and Democrats when it when it comes to regime change issues, as your guest in London referred to, is going to be quite beneficial for a lot of Iranians that do see a difference between these two parties when it comes to their aim with regard to Iran. They do have differences in how engage in tactics, but in terms of their ultimate goal, I don't see a difference. And that idea is going to be accepted by a lot of people in Iran if the Biden administration continues on the same path that they have started.
Okay, I'm going to come back to you with another piece after I ask our guest, Seydou Sadabas, my next question, but I'm going to come back to you, Professor Izadi, with another piece of news out there that Iran has rejected in the past 48 hours. Okay, Seydou Sadabas, so a simple question comes out of what you said. If the U.S. is after regime change in Iran, what is it doing at the negotiating table then with at this point with E4? It should just come out, but yet we're seeing these negotiations go on.
Well, by continuing these talks, as I said, what they're going to do is really try to distract, try to slow Iran down, also create confusion, ideally, amongst the Islamic Republic of Iran's population. You see, if you get a debate going by keeping these things, try to make the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership look perhaps as though it's incalcitrant, it doesn't want to negotiate, and it's bringing hardship on its own people. This is the narrative that they've been pushing by putting the economic sanctions ever more tightly and ever more expansively. They want to try and convince also the grassroots population to say, look, we're fed up of all these sanctions. Why don't we just compromise and go for the deal, which at least gets us back into the American good books? Well, the thing is, the problem with that, of course, is that it won't satisfy the Americans or the Israelis. What you're going to do is you give away one element, and they're going to want more and more and more. This is the nature of the imperialist beast. It's a fact of life that they're looking for the vulnerability and the weakness within Iran. If they were being truly fair, what the Americans would be looking on this table is that Iran is willing to forego its nuclear, even its peaceful nuclear development, essentially. And what they're also getting out of the deal, if they were to go for it, is the fact that actually they're not having being brought into any kind of denuclearization package in West Asia, at least, if not beyond. I mean, what principally should happen is that the Israelis, who have nuclear capability, who are the main problem in the Middle East for peace, are being allowed to have a carte blanche, and they're not being given special JCPOA-style deals. Why is that not happening? I mean, of course, Israel is the fundamental problem in that region. They're not being asked to come in front of an inquisition. Why is Iran particularly being picked out? Iran hasn't done anything that really validates even the idea of a JCPOA agreement coming into the equation. Then, of course, there's the proxy, the other proxy, Saudi Arabia. The Americans have given a complete green light to their own nuclear development agencies and corporate companies to go in and actually develop nuclear capability in Saudi Arabia. Those tenders are out. It's public knowledge. So on the one hand, you've got an attitude towards the Islamic Republic of Iran where you're trying to bind them down in a deal which now you've reneged on, walked out unilaterally, and are still dragging your feet and doing economic terrorism as a result of it for your own gains. But on the other side, in the same region, you're allowing nations like Saudi Arabia, who are obviously antagonistic to the Islamic Republic of Iran, you're actually financing and supporting their development of nuclear weapons, potentially. And, of course, the despotic regimes there are not under question.
Okay. So, Professor Izadi, I talked about how I'm going to ask you about the second piece of news out there in the past 48 hours that's come out if you can clarify for us. This comes from Reuters, how it said Iran and world powers have made some progress on how to revive the 2015 nuclear accord. No news there, later abandoned by the U.S., and an interim deal could be a way to gain time for a lasting settlement. And they've said that Iranian officials have said that. Now, Iran's top nuclear negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, has said that there is no discussion on an interim agreement or similar topic in the Vienna talks. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, one issue that is the elephant in the room is Iran's election, the presidential election in June. We have this situation internally there are people who may want to use these type of negotiations as a sort of a winning card in the debates that the country will have when people decide to choose the next president in Iran. So having an interim agreement is going to be attractive for political reasons that is in line with the election that is coming up. But I don't think, since you asked my opinion, I don't think this is going to work out. I think given the experience of JCPOA in 2015, and given the fact that even the Obama administration did not follow JCPOA properly when they were in office until January of 2017. I don't think the Iranian leadership, the country's leadership, will go with a project or a scheme that is designed to basically affect the results of Iran's election. The result is going to be, if the Americans continue on the current path, is that you are not going to have an agreement, and these talks will fail if the Biden administration continues with its current line of thinking.
Thank you very much for that. It was a pleasure. Fouad Azadi, university professor and political analyst. You answered many questions. We do appreciate that. Of course, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, your analysis. Thank you very much. Journalist and political commentator there from London. Many thanks to you both. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tahavi, entire team here in the capital, Tehran is goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In February, Illinois enacted a law that rewrote many of the state's rules for policing and mandated that police officers wear body cameras. In March, New York City moved to make it easier for citizens to sue police officers. This month, the Maryland legislature, which decades ago became the first to adopt a law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights, became the first state to do away with it. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Steve Eder, Michael Keller, and Blackie Migliozzi. The piece is titled, "As New Police Reform Laws Sweep Across the United States, Some Ask, Are They Enough?" February, Illinois enacted a law that rewrote many of the state's rules of policing and mandated that police officers wear body cameras. In March, New York City moved to make it easier for citizens to sue police officers. This month, the Maryland legislature, which decades ago became the first state to adopt a law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights, became the first state to do away with it. In recent months, state and city lawmakers across the country have seized on a push for reform prompted by outrage at the killing of George Floyd last May, passing legislation that has stripped the police of some hard-fought protections won over the past half a century. Police unions in the United States are pretty much playing defense at the moment, said Brian Marvel, a San Diego, California police officer and the president of California's largest law enforcement labor organization. He added, "You have groups of people that are looking for change, and some groups are looking for radical change." Over 30 states have passed more than 140 new police oversight and reform laws, according to a New York Times analysis of data from the National Conference of State Legislatures. Amber Widgery, a police expert at the organization, said many of the laws restricting the use of force, overhauling disciplinary systems, installing more civilian oversight, and requiring transparency around misconduct cases give states far more influence over policing practices that have typically been left to local jurisdictions. We're seeing the creation of really strong centralized state guidance that sets a baseline for police accountability, police behavior, and standards for all departments, she said. It's a remarkable nationwide and in some places bipartisan movement that flies directly counter to years of deference to the police and their powerful unions. But the laws and new rules adopted by police departments across the country are not enough to satisfy demands by Black Lives Matter and other activists who are pushing for wholesale reforms, cultural shifts, and cutbacks at law enforcement agencies. The focus has been so heavily on what do we do after harm has already been committed, after the police have already engaged in misconduct, and far less focused on how do we stop this from the beginning, said Paige Fernandez, an advocate at the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. While Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer accused of murdering George Floyd, was on trial last week, episodes in Virginia, Minnesota, and Illinois, which have all enacted reforms, underscored how the new laws would not always prevent traumatic outcomes. A police officer in Virginia was seen on video pointing a gun at a Black Army lieutenant and pepper spraying him during a traffic stop. A veteran police officer in Minnesota fatally shot a 20-year-old, Daunte Wright, a Black man, after pulling him over. And video recordings showed a Chicago police officer chasing and fatally firing at a 13-year-old teenager, Adam Toledo, a Latino, after he appeared to toss aside a gun whilst obeying commands to raise his hands. The events ignited fresh protests and more questions about why police officers and police interventions escalated into deaths of people of color. People aren't necessarily happy with the change they're seeing, because the same thing keeps happening again and again, said Savanta Clark, whose brother, Stephen, was killed by the Sacramento police in 2018. California enacted a law named after his brother that raised the standard for using lethal force. But Savanta Clark sees a need for the federal government to impose national regulations. House Democrats recently passed a sweeping police bill designed to address racial discrimination and excessive use of force by police officers, but it lacks the Republican support needed in the Senate. President Joe Biden has also fallen short of a campaign promise to establish an oversight commission during his first 100 days in office. Nearly 1,000 people have been shot and killed by police officers annually in recent years, according to data from the Washington Post, which also shows that police officers fatally shot black and Hispanic people at a much higher rate by population than whites. Some activists have cheered new laws that could curb police misconduct, mainly in states and cities controlled by Democrats. But they also fear that those changes could be offset in Republican jurisdictions that are proposing to expand police protections or impose harsher penalties for protest-related activities like blocking highways and defacing public property. Police unions, along with many Republican lawmakers, have resisted some of the reform efforts, arguing that they will imperil public safety. But there have been some signs of bipartisanship. In Colorado, for example, Republicans joined with Democrats, who controlled the state house, to pass a sweeping bill less than a month after George Floyd's death. The law banned chokeholds, required police officers to intervene if they witness excessive force, and mandated body cameras statewide within 3 years, among other provisions. The Colorado legislature became the first to eliminate immunity from civil rights accusations, allowing police officers to face claims in state courts. John Cook, a Republican state senator and former Colorado County sheriff, worked with Democrats to revise their proposals. Officials, he said, realized that we need to do something, and we need to do it now. Republican-led states, including Iowa and Utah, have implemented changes too, banning or restricting chokeholds, among other measures. But Iowa's Republican-controlled House recently passed a Back the Blue bill that black lawmakers said could unfairly affect peaceful protesters and amounted to retaliation against Democrats. In Maryland, the democratically controlled legislature overrode a veto by the state's Republican governor to pass a sweeping reform package. Outlining his objections, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said the laws would be damaging to police recruitment and police retention, posing significant risks to public safety. Importantly, the package erases the Law Enforcement Officers' Bill of Rights in the state, a landmark achievement for police unions in the 1970s. Decades ago, similar protections spread across the country in union contracts and local laws, but its passage in Maryland gave broad protections to every department at once. Critics said the policing Bill of Rights reduced accountability. Police officers could wait days before being questioned about an allegation. Only fellow police officers could conduct interrogations. Some complaints could be expunged from an officer's file after a few years. It is fitting that Maryland is the first state to repeal it, as they opened this Pandora's box in the first place, said Kaylin Young, public policy director at the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland. Maryland's new laws contain a range of provisions to rein in policing: a body camera requirement for police officers regularly interacting with the public, prison sentences up to 10 years for violations of the state's use of force policy, and restrictions on so-called no-knock warrants. Those warrants drew national attention last year when the police in Louisville, Kentucky, fatally shot Breonna Taylor, an unarmed emergency medical technician, after smashing through her apartment door during a botched drug raid. Louisville banned the warrants last summer, and state lawmakers limited their use this month. Another Maryland law, named after Anton Black, requires disclosure of information about police misconduct investigations. The 19-year-old Anton Black died in 2018 after police officers pinned him to the ground following a struggle. Prosecutors did not pursue charges in this case, but his family has sued in federal court. LaToya Holly, Anton Black's sister, said that the new laws would help, but that a broader shift in policing was needed. That culture and that mentality has to do a complete 180-degree turn if we want to enact changes, she said. And it has to start in-house with the police departments, the police captains and chiefs, and also the boards that are actually certifying these police officers. Maryland's new standards follow a decision by Baltimore State's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, to stop prosecuting minor crimes like prostitution and drug possession. When we criminalize these minor offenses that have nothing to do with public safety, we expose people to needless interaction with law enforcement that, for black people in this country, can often lead to a death sentence, Ms. Mosby told the Baltimore City Council last week.